And today we're going to look at the United Kingdom. So we're moving along. I want to remind you before we do anything, before I read anything, I am so impressed with the fact that this whole biblical story follows the whole faith development story of the different stages of faith that these people go through. And that's brilliant, because the people that put the Old Testament together didn't have the understanding of faith development stages. Yet, they stuck to those levels. And another thing to remember is God always meets people where they are. So, you know, we need to dig into their story and understand what was happening historically, where they were, and God then shows up in a way that they will understand. Now, the big issue is worshiping other gods. Well, we don't have cultures around us that worship other gods, but we have other gods that take control over our lives. So it's important for us to read the stories and understand that they are family stories, and things happen, like somebody doesn't kill somebody else after the war, and because of that, they're out. You know, they've broken the rule of holy wars. Well, we don't have that rule now. So we don't pay attention to that speaking to us, that when we overtake somebody that we ought to kill them, you know, the way they did, that was their understanding of holy war. But we have to figure out, under the story, what is it that went wrong? And what went wrong is that person did not pay attention to the rules of worshiping Yahweh, their God, at that time. Do you hear that? Mm-hmm. Okay.
I was reading some of that, kind of taken aback by how
of
many
course.
People were killed.
Yes.
And for what reason?
Right.
I mean, it was like, okay, well, go over there and take care of that guy.
Right.
He's at the altar.
Right. Okay. Right. Now you can get him. Right.
And just kind of goes along.
Well, that's where they went wrong, by not killing the guy when they did do it. But that's because that's how they understood that they had to worship Yahweh. That doesn't mean that's how they were supposed to, but it's how they understood. And that whole business of holy war is that you're not supposed to profit from overrunning and taking over another people. You burn everything down, or you tear it all down, which is to our advantage today, because then we've got levels of archaeology. See, from what they've done through the centuries. And you're not supposed to take hostages. You're supposed to kill them all. You're not supposed to benefit. That's during their time. But it was a lesson they needed to learn. During their time, the rules were made about, if you worship Yahweh, this is how it is. That doesn't mean that that's how it is now. It's just like, I have come to an understanding, and you don't have to be there with me, but my understanding of God is that God's Spirit is in all of creation, including my dog Max, including all of nature. And nature speaks to me. It really does. At very crucial times, I've had experiences with animals and nature that have spoken to me. Now, you know, people in the past have claimed that that's pantheism, you know, that you're worshiping the wrong thing. Well, that's not where I am. I'm past that, and I understand the Spirit of God, for me, is in everything that God has created, not just human beings. And I'm perfectly comfortable with that, but I'm comfortable if you aren't, because that's where you are. but we need to allow ourselves to grow in spiritual development. And let's speak to us what does. Did you read that whole business about the black hole that they found the picture? And that Einstein actually described that. Unbelievable. That was in the paper today.
We had a minister who said he believed in God on the molecular level.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, every single molecule in the world
has God in it.
Has God in it.
Yeah.
That clarified things for me.
That's a good way to say it. Mm-hmm. Well, today we're at a place, and I love the fact that God meets people where they are. So God does meet me where I am. And nature does speak to me from God. Do you see what I'm saying? That doesn't work at every time in history. But be comfortable with what speaks to you about what God is saying to you. Today, we're beginning to go into some organization with our people. And a couple of things I want to read to you, because this is what happens during this time in faith development. Fear is one quality that becomes very powerful. Here's a description of fear. Fear has a large shadow, but he himself is quite small. That's hard to remember when you're fearful of something. He has a vivid imagination. He composes horror music in the middle of the night, and boy, I think we've all lived long enough to have had those experiences. He is not very social, and he keeps to himself at political meetings. His past is a mystery. He wanted us not to talk to each other about him, adding that there is nowhere any of us could go where he wouldn't hear us. We were quiet. When we began to talk to each other, he changed. His manners started to seem pompous. His snarling voice sounded rehearsed. Two dragons guard Fear's mansion. One is ceramic and Chinese. The other is real. If you make it past the dragons and speak to him up close, it is amazing how fragile he is. In other words, don't be quiet about your fears. Be honest. He will try to tell you stories. Be aware. He is a master of disguises and illusions. Fear almost convinced me that he was a puppet maker and I was a marionette. Speak out boldly, look him in the eye, startle him. Don't give up. Win his respect, he'll never bother you with small matters again. Fear. That's one man's description of fear. The other thing that comes up during this time in faith development is jealousy. You know, these are the teen years and the early adult years, usually, where our people are trying to figure out who they are, what's important in their lives, how they're going to conduct their lives. Well, it's fear and jealousy that are the most important emotions. Jealousy stands by the blue flame of the gas stove, stirring obsession stew. In his mind, he is tearing people limb from limb. He wears a shirt that is almost in style with its odd angular shapes and bright edges. He can be quite charming when he wants to be. He certainly has a flair for drama. After a while, though, the roles that jealousy begins to take seem to be shallow, dishonest, and repetitive. The more upset he feels, the more loudly he denies it. For a time, I stopped giving parties because he wouldn't come if I invited certain people. At that point, I couldn't give a party without inviting him, and I was unwilling to censor my guest list for his sake. He is quite capable of showing up anywhere, unexpected, uninvited, unwelcome. And, you know, you have to think about that a little bit, but jealousy, well, it's obvious that you see that in teenagers especially, and especially, you know, kids that are really, really jealous and fearful. Both those things are very prevalent. In adults, it becomes much more clothed and harder to figure out. But, you know, I've mentioned this before. At our age, it's quite easy to detect the people who are jealous and the people who are not. And the people who are jealous are usually protecting their position, their power, their image, and they're very self-protective, and they're not easy to be with because you feel like you're walking on eggs all the time. They're always defending themselves, and fear goes along with that because they're fearful that they're going to lose their power, they're going to lose their images. You know, it's interesting to think about that. Because people our age are past the point of being able to, I guess that wasn't a gun, was it? they're past the point of building their empires. They're living in their empires. They're living behind closed doors or gated communities, and I don't mean that literally, but it helps to understand people when you understand that those are the two emotions that are just so powerful. And when you're constantly working to protect those two emotions, it's very hard to grow spiritually because you're never open. You're never open to realize the two deer that have walked up to my kitchen window the morning after Jack had major brain surgery were deer that were telling me it's going to be okay. Don't worry about it. You're just not open to that kind of thing when you're more concerned about yourself and you're overcome with fear. So be aware of those things. Any other questions? I handed out those stages of faith, and you know, we really didn't talk about them very much, so now's the time if you've got comments or questions, I'm hoping that it helps you if you're reading through the Old Testament, that you're able to pinpoint the people that they're at a certain stage in their faith development. They're not where we are. They're not supposed to be. And the beauty is that the Bible, the biblical people, included all of their nasty stories. I mean, I think if I were to write my family story, I'm not so sure I'd include all the nasty things about me. You know, well, you didn't do them. No, somebody did them to you. I can do it. I can include people if they did it to me. And if life did, you know, and life did do some nasty stuff to me at a very early age. But, you know, that's how you grow. If you don't get stuck in feeling sorry for yourself, and then you understand yourself better. That's how you grow. So I asked if there were questions or statements, and then I didn't shut up. So anybody have anything they want to say at this point? Otherwise, I've got a bunch of handouts again. Last week I gave you the handout about that included Saul. This week I'm going to give you a handout that's all about David, and another one that's all about Solomon. Because we're going to look at all three of them today. And then I've got a few others, but I think I'll hand these out later. I don't know if anybody remembers, if I gave out the sketch of the Old Testament history, which gives world datings, patriarchal period, the national, here, I'll give it out. If it looks familiar, don't take it. I got a bunch of things here. I should have warned you to get a notebook to put all this stuff in. And here's another one, History of Israel and the books, the time in world history these things happen, and then the books beneath it that tell you where the story is found. just, I think it's easier when you've got stuff like this that you can follow. And the last one I'm going to give you is a map. And it's a map that shows the divided kingdom, which is where we will be today, shows where Judah, the tribe of Judah, is southern Israel, and all the rest of the tribes are in northern Israel, and they're called Israel. And that's on one side, and the other side shows you where the prophets lived. And next week we will look at all the prophets, major and minor, so you can read all of those guys, because they're the ones that end up being the voice for God. Once we get into the kingship, the kings don't speak for God, the prophets do. I don't think that we would think our president speaks for God. We need prophets speaking for God. I don't know, if you think I've handed some of these out before, feel free to not keep them. I'm gonna get up and get, I need to tell my recorder I'm coming back.
You've got to be good to the teacher.
You have got it going. I wouldn't dare not give you an A. Okay.
Judy, who would you say is the most important prophet?
Lots of them. You know.
But one doesn't stand out?
No. Well, Samuel, you know, he is major at a time before they become kings. Isaiah, you know, is a giant. But they all have their place. They all make a difference because of where they are in history. So it would be hard for me to say one is more important than the other. I think we hear about Isaiah more, you know, during our time. But
why do they classify them?
Major and minor. That'll be next week. I've got all that stuff for next week. So, yeah, I just gave you the map that shows them a week kind of ahead of time. But I wanted you to also see in the Promised Land, they're not united, you know, and Judah is a big land in the south. And all the rest of the tribes are up in the north under the name of Israel. And they didn't even take over the whole land. You know, other people still inhabit other parts. But the struggle from now on becomes between the political and the religious. And the religious always comes out ahead in our story after a long time. The prophets really do win out. And the beauty is we know the New Testament. And Jesus doesn't come up with saying or doing anything new. He does what the prophets tell the people way back here in history what they should be doing. And you'll see that next year. The shift that takes place economically from the Bronze Age to the Iron Age was very important economically and politically, but there are repercussions from that. As the nation gets stronger and stronger, and it does under David, and that's the kingdom of Judah, things change because the people become very complacent, happy to have more money, more jobs, they're more economically successful. Not different from this time. It compares with this time when the nuclear age started. When the nuclear age came, everything has been different ever since. That nuclear bomb that got dropped changed the scene of the whole world. And now it's all about power. Who has the most bombs? And boy, is Trump trying to get North Korea to get rid of their bombs. They'll never do it. They'll never do it. They are crazy if they do it. So backing up a little bit to Saul, and that was last week, we didn't talk about him, but he's on last week's paper that I gave you about Saul. Saul is part of a transitional period between the tribal confederacy and the new order. He possessed divine charisma. That's why he rose to the top at that point. He had the personality and the charisma to rally the people. He was chosen by the prophet, you know, that he needed to be the one. And he ended the Philistines' monopoly of iron smelting. He ended that for the Philistines. Philistines were always their enemy. And when he ended that economically, you know, then things really started to turn around. He was more like an ancient judge than a king. He called himself a prince or a leader. His task was to fight Yahweh's battles. But he made a mistake. His first mistake is in 1 Samuel 13. And I'll back up and just point it out to you if I can find it. 1 Samuel 13. And I won't read the whole thing. 1 Samuel 13, 8 to 14. He waited 7 days. Saul is waiting for Samuel, the prophet, to tell him what to do. And he waited 7 days for Samuel to come, but Samuel did not come. And so the people were leaving. They were waiting to go to battle. And the people were leaving, and they really couldn't start the battle until they had Samuel's blessing. But Samuel didn't come at the time Saul wanted him to come. So he said, bring the burnt offering here to me and the peace offering. And he did what Samuel was supposed to do. That's his first. And, you know, to us that sounds like nothing, except that was a rule about worshiping Yahweh, that you allow the person who speaks for Yahweh to do his job. Further on down, he said in 12, he said, verse 12, I said, now the Philistines are going to come and overtake us if I don't do something fast. So I forced myself to make the offering. He knew he had done the wrong thing. That's his first mistake. And then the second mistake that comes along is his own son. Jonathan also breaks the rules. I won't bother going into all this because you can read this for yourself. But he breaks the rules too. And then Saul breaks the rules in chapter 15, about 15:9. Saul and the people, they overtook the Amalekites. Saul defeated the Amalekites. And then, instead of paying attention to the rules of holy war, he saved the leader of the Amalekites, Agag. He took him as a confidant. And he should have sacrificed him because that was the rule at the time. It's a terrible rule to us today, but it's making a point that you keep the rules of God, even though that's how they understood the rule to be. We don't understand that about God anymore. We're at a higher level of faith development, of understanding who God is. They were not. So you got to forgive them for this, a little about that. But then, because of Saul breaking so many rules, Samuel, the prophet, leaves him. He actually goes over into the David camp, and it drives Saul, absolutely bananas. I mean, he practically, well, he ends up taking his own life, in a sense, because he is just emotionally so distraught, he doesn't even want to go on and live, because he believes that God's spirit has left him, because Samuel left him. And, you know, we could look at that a little bit. When we break the rules, when we don't keep God as the God in our lives of everything, things go from bad to worse, personally, you know, and pretty soon we're in big trouble, and then we need to go to counseling, Doug. That's how Doug earned his living, counseling people who broke the rules. No, but seriously, you do get screwed up. You really do. The prophet speaks for God. Saul spoke for Saul. And that's what happened to him. He was impulsive, and he made that break, you know, between the king and the prophet. He lost God. The absence of God's prophet was the absence of God. And we need to, you know, we can dig that into that story and apply what it's trying to say to us today. We aren't healthy. You know, we're sitting in an AA room. These people would understand what I'm saying. Something got a hold of them and controlled them. And many of them lost their families, lost their jobs, lost their homes. Things go from bad to worse when you allow the wrong thing to control you. Don't worry about the details of the story. That's where they were in terms of their faith development. So we cannot judge them, but we can learn. We can learn what the story is saying. God, Samuel, David, and Jonathan were all against Saul, probably against Saul. And then along comes David. Samuel gives David the go-ahead that he is the next king. Of all the kings, and there are many of them that occur, you know, in their history, the top three we're looking at today, but of all the kings, David does it the best, meaning religiously and politically. He was brilliant politically. Religiously, he knew God and honored God. They also include his humanness, you know, where he's strolling along on his rooftop and sees this beautiful babe sunbathing in the nude and wants her, and can then, because of his own needs and wants, he contrives to have her husband killed. He's in the army, and he makes sure that her husband is put in the front line for the next big battle so he can get what he wants. The beauty of that is this is the top guy in all of the Israel history, and he's human. So don't be so hard on yourselves, because if he makes it into the story as the top guy, what are we worried about? Seriously, you know, that allows us to be honest. Like, you've got to be honest with your fears. You've got to be honest about the jealousy. You got to be honest about yourself. God is not going to reject you. That's what this story says to me. So, 1 Samuel 16, the choice of David comes along. The Lord said to Samuel, "How long will you grieve over Saul?" Because Samuel really, even though he left Saul, he loved him. "And seeing that I've rejected him from being king over Israel, fill your horn with oil, go and anoint David." So Samuel does that. Now we have a transition that develops with David from becoming a charismatic leadership and being handed down now. We're going to hand it down, not to another charismatic person, but it's going to be the royal leadership. It's going to stay in the family. So David's son is another story. But Saul, now he was part of Israel, and David is part of Judah, which shows you on your map. Judah is just one tribe that has grown to be fully in charge. But we've got David. I've got a few things about David. David's ability to inspire love and loyalty was remarkable, like no other biblical figure, until the appearance of Jesus. During one battle in which he was severely pressed, David expressed a longing for a cool drink of water from a well in Bethlehem, apparently several miles away. Without hesitation, three of his men broke through the enemy lines to get him a drink of water. That's the kind of person that David was, and everybody around him loved him. On another occasion, David and his soldiers had to flee for their safety. A foreigner, a Hittite, who had just joined David, wanted to go with them. "Why are you going with us?" he said to the foreigner. "You're a foreigner. You've only lived here a short time. So why should I make you walk around and wander with me?" Hittai said, "Your Majesty, I will always go with you wherever you go, even if it means death." That's the and those stories are in the Bible. But that's the kind of person David was. Amazing. I don't know that we've ever had a president that even falls into that category. You know, somebody who really sees it clearly, and all the people around him see that also and respect him for that. So we have a uniting of the North and South going on under David. Joab was David's military commander. Abner was Saul's military commander. Even though David has been anointed by Samuel, Saul still figures himself to be the king, but he lives in the south. Abner makes Saul's son, after Saul dies, Ishbosheth, the figurehead king of the north, up in the north after Saul dies. And David has been anointed by Samuel to be king in the south. So we've got a division going on. David's gestures of goodwill, though, mean he genuinely mourns Saul's death when Saul dies. He thanks the men of the north for rescuing Saul's body so he can have a proper funeral. Abner, at this point, when Saul dies, this is interesting, Abner, his commander, wants Saul's concubine for his own. This is jealousy stuff. I'm bringing this out because if you read this, you're going to think, what the heck is this all about? Well, wants Saul's concubine because if he has Saul's concubine, then he has a share of the kingship. So she obviously doesn't get just thrown away. Whatever his name is, says no. So Abner goes to David. Abner's mad because Abner didn't get the concubine. So he says, because of that, I'm leaving you. And he goes up down south and goes to David. David apologizes to the north for the death of Abner. As Abner is approaching the kingdom that David has in Judah, he's seen as a foreigner because he's part of Saul, and they kill him. And that's not what David wanted. So David apologizes to all the people in the north for the killing of Abner. But Ishbosheth's power was crumbling. I don't want to read all of this, but Ishbosheth, a son of Saul, was legitimate successor to the throne. his head had not the right positions for crown bearing. That's the writer's way of saying he never should have become king. He only went through the motions. Behind the throne was Abner, who controlled everything. And he was just a puppet king. He wasn't good enough to do what he was supposed to be doing. One of the things David does, and this is interesting because of what our president just did, he makes Jerusalem a neutral city that is the political and religious center of Israel. Isn't that something? Because our own president just made Jerusalem the head of all of Israel. So during that time in history, it was legitimate, and Israel was up near the border of the north and the south, so everybody could get to it. It was at this point we have what is known as royal theology. It's all supposedly okayed by God, and that God is going to continue to be the leader of the nation Israel. But we've lost the ability for charismatic leadership. And what happens during this time, and I'm in 2 Samuel, verse chapter 7, when your days are fulfilled and you lie down with your fathers, I will raise up an offspring after you who shall come forth from your body, and I'll establish his kingdom. So this is the royal leadership, and Nathan the prophet is saying that. Nathan is his prophet. We now have a state-supported religion. In this country, our founders were very clear, never a state-supported religion. Separation of church and state. They never said, we have to be Christian, or we have to be Jewish. We just are free to be who we need to be. So we have an official state-supported religion, and it's very dangerous, which we will see as time goes on in their history. The king had the power over the clergy now in the states, if there was clergy, but they didn't use that term. But there was no separation of church and state. Militarily, David took over the Philistines. Nathan the prophet had a close relationship with David. God's promise to David, which is what I just read now, is a promise to the bloodline. That's scary. That's like the queen, you know, in England, but she doesn't rule, so to speak. She has a political system that rules. No more charismatic leadership. David expanded Israel's territory, owned one piece of ground called the Fertile Crescent. David did some amazing things. He also wrote some psalms, and if we have time today, I do have a handout about psalms a little bit. We don't spend a lot of time, but Psalm 24, the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, the world and those who dwell therein. And it goes on and on. This is a psalm of David. And David wrote a lot of them. He moved the ark. Remember the ark of the covenant? He moved it to Jerusalem. Nathan would not allow them to build a building to put the ark in. He said the ark always has to stay in a tent. You know, in the past 30 years or so, I've often thought when I see that, and that's the 30 years have been years of the big mega churches being built and the big real estate, we would be probably better off as churches if we'd stayed in the tents, except not in Michigan with this weather. But seriously, real estate. Real estate always trips you. Because then you got to please the people in the pews that have given the money for all the real estate. If you've got a big mega complex. That's why I like this church so much, because we're building now. You have to do that, but we're not trying to become a big extravaganza, you know, piece of real estate. And I saw it. I saw it, and I knew it. There are some places in this community where real estate was built from some very wealthy people, and the pastors in the pews had to be very careful that they didn't ever offend those people. You're compromised. So Nathan was smart. We're not building a building for that ark. That ark is going to stay the way it always has been, so we always remember. We never forget where we came from. Buildings in Jerusalem were designed by the Phoenicians, who had been the Canaanites. They grow during this time. This is an economically very good time. But not all the Israelites are doing the building. You know, other powers are coming in that are making a big difference. But the people were beginning to feel the yoke of centralized power. I want to go back to 2 Samuel, 2 Samuel 20, verses 1 and 2. Now, there happened to be there a worthless fellow whose name was Sheba, the son of Bichri, a Benjaminite, and he blew the temple. He was the leader of the revolt team against the kingship. We have no portion in David, and we have no inheritance in the son of Jesse. Every man to his tent, so Israel. So all the men of Israel withdrew from David. Those were the people that had come from the north. You know, we hear that. We hear that in our time in history, too. You know, the rich are getting richer and the poor, the middle class is disappearing. We have no portion. It's the same kind of thing. Then we got the David and Bathsheba story, and it goes downhill for poor David from now on, because he has to protect himself. And the psalm you read from David is Psalm 51. This is a very poignant psalm, and this is what comes when Nathan points out to him what he has done. Have mercy on me, O God, according to thy steadfast love, according to thy abundant mercy, blot out my transgressions. If you understand that this is what it came from, Nathan has confronted him and said, you're the one. And this is the psalm. Wash me thoroughly from my iniquity, cleanse me from my sin. For I know my transgressions, and my sin is ever before me, and so forth. I don't have to read it all, but down in verse 11, he says, cast me not away from your presence. Take not away your Holy Spirit. Don't leave me. Restore to me the joy of my salvation, and uphold me with a willing spirit. Teach me, forgive me, help me, is what this psalm is all about. He has been confronted, and he recognizes it and admits. That's the beauty of David. But another one is Psalm 139. See if I can find it, just to get a couple of lines. O Lord, thou hast searched me and known me. Thou knowest when I sit down and rise up. Thou discernest my thoughts from afar. Thou searchest out my path, my lying down. It's all about, even before a word is on my tongue, O Lord, you know it all together. You are with me, behind me, and before me, and layest thy hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high, I cannot attain it. The realization that spirit is always with him, always around him, increases his sense of guilt. But the fact that he acknowledges it and begs forgiveness and wants to be better is the beauty of David. There's another episode. I don't think I'm going to bother with it, but it's in 2 Samuel. One episode swiftly follows another in poor David's life. Amnon, there's a story about Amnon, 2 Samuel 13. Forced his half-sister and Absalom to have sex together. And revenge takes place, and Amnon is estranged from David and Absalom and starts a revolution. And, you know, it's a snowball effect. It happens to David, and it happens to us. That snowball effect, you got to put the brakes on. And that's what we do or did, and you will, Amy, for your daughter when she reaches this stage of pushing the limits. And we do, even in our adult lives, if we're not so busy protecting our images and our power and all that stuff that we can get caught up in, you want to be caught. I used to pray for my own kids that whatever they were doing, they'd get caught. And they got caught sooner rather than later. Because when it goes on undetected for too long, they think they can get away with everything, and it snowballs. And that's what we see in this story of David, the snowballing. It's very poignant, you know, how they construct this story so you can see that it's one sin leads to another if you don't get caught. Absalom is David's son. He starts a revolt, ends up being killed by Joab, and he's dangling from it. It's sadness. It's just all sadness. Treachery and intrigue go on forever, you know. And David was a victim of his own greatness, of a strong will that urged him to scale the tempting heights of power, and then he played God. Then he played God. That's the part that's hard not to do. The result of David's kingship is that the whole character of Israel had changed. It was now no longer based on a covenant allegiance. It was to God. Israel was now bound politically to a covenant between the king and the people, not God. The king was speaking for God, and that's a disaster. The people gave their allegiance to the king, who could put them in the army, demand forced labor, require complete submission to his power. That's what Hitler did. You know, he went over the line, and it was a horrible thing. The net result in history is practically what the prophet Samuel said would happen. Samuel predicts it back in 2 Samuel. Would Israel make the mistake of the Davidic state for God's sake? And imagine what, wait a minute, would Samuel make the Davidic state for God? And imagine that in it God had established his kingdom. So no matter what David did, everybody just assumed that was God speaking through. No. We need to speak up. We didn't soon enough in Germany. You know, Hitler went to a Lutheran church every single Sunday. He was a card-carrying Lutheran, doing what he felt was the right thing in God's name for the sake of Germany. That's scary stuff. I mean, that's an example in our history that's as bad as it can get. But it happens all the time, you know, in lesser levels for our own sake. Will our destiny as a nation which calls itself Christian, this comes back from the 70s, I wrote this, be satisfied in terms of economic prosperity and the national might which we've created? Are we going to be satisfied as a nation that we call ourselves Christians? Are we satisfied that we're economically maybe better than anybody else, have more bombs than anybody else? Or are we going to take a stand for what is right if we consider ourselves Christians as members of the country, not Christians as the corporate thing for the whole nation? The prophecy shows up in 2 Samuel. You know, later the prophets pick this up in talking about a future king, spirit of Yahweh on a king. The Psalms come from this time in history, from David's time and from the next king, Solomon. David came to the throne the hard way, up from the shepherd's field and the warrior's rough life. His greatness was that he never rose so high as to be cut off from the common soil that had nourished him. He cared about the people. He always cared about people. David's story shows up again in Chronicles. The whole kingship story shows up again in Chronicles. Here's an interest in moving on to Solomon. An interesting quote out of Deuteronomy 17, 14 to 20. And this is from a long time before Solomon, but Solomon 17, 14 to 20. This is Moses. The writer puts these words into the mouth of Moses a long time before Solomon. When you come to the land which the Lord your God gives to you, and you possess it and dwell in it, and then say, I will set a king over me like all the other nations around me, you may indeed set as a king over you whom the Lord your God will choose, one from your among your brethren who shall set as king over you. You may not put a foreigner over you, but it has to be somebody that's your brother. Only he must not multiply horses for himself. This is a description of Solomon's reign, back out of the mouth of Moses. And you know he didn't say this. But putting the story together, they make it come out of the mouth of Moses. Or cause the people to return to Egypt in order to multiply horses. You know, this is business. Since the Lord has said to you, you shall never return there that way again, and you shall not multiply wives for yourselves, lest his heart turn away, nor shall he greatly multiply for himself silver and gold. And when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, he shall write for himself in a book a copy of this law. Don't forget the Ten Commandments. From that which is in the charge of the Levitical priests, and it shall be with him, and he shall read it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God by keeping all the words of the law and statutes and doing them, that his heart may not be lifted up above his brethren, and that he may not turn aside from the commandment, either to the right or to the left, so that he may continue his long kingdom. That is a description of what Solomon does. Solomon is born to the purple. He did nothing to become king. He just was. And there's a whole story about him becoming king and somebody else wanting to be king. He's ambitious. He's selfish. His in the building he built for himself, all the walls are mirror. Solid mirrors. So everywhere he walks, he can see himself. So whenever you hear about Solomon's court, now you know what they're talking about. A very self-centered person. that reflected he saw himself being reflected and saw himself as great. Now, when you go into 1 Kings, you will see that he does have some accomplishments. There's always good in every person. Internal security, he sets that out. Economic development, he controls the trade routes. The trade routes are set up into the Mediterranean. And this is crucial because they're in place long time from now when Paul hits the road bringing the word about Jesus. And he goes on the trade routes all over the Mediterranean, the trade routes that Solomon began. Isn't that interesting? He began a shipping business. He developed a copper business. He built copper smelting plant and put the copper on ships and sold it. I mean, he was brilliant in some respects. Standard of living improved. He was a horse importer, like Moses said he shouldn't be. And chariots were built. Culturally, he built the temple. He centralized religion and politics more. He wrote some of the Proverbs, some of Ecclesiastes, some of the Psalms, and the Song of Solomon. He wrote those things. He was an intelligent man. He was educated, obviously. He was a botanist. That's an interesting part of him. He cared about nature. Let's see if I can find it. I think it's in 1 Kings 4. I'm in 2 Kings. There's always good, you know, in every, I don't know what good there was in Hitler, but there, if you made it into the Bible, you made it in for a reason. 4:33-34. It might be in 2 Kings. It's in 2 Kings. Oh, no. 33. He spoke of trees from the cedar that is in Lebanon to the hyssop that grows out of the wall. He spoke of the beasts and of the birds and of reptiles and fish. I'd probably like him. And men came from all peoples to hear the wisdom of Solomon and from all kings of the earth who had heard of his wisdom. So he was brilliant. He broke down, he was a botanist. His weaknesses. He did not expand territory. He kept it within the nation of Israel. So he had to generate wealth. He had to generate heavy taxes. He was forced to form alliances with other countries so they'd be free, so they'd be safe. And he did that by marrying. He married many wives from all over the kingdom in that area. And he had other people marry, you know. So Moses said, don't have a lot of wives. Well, that's written after they know what Solomon did. Nepotism or favoritism. You know, if you graced his palm with money, you got something in return. You needed to make sure you were in his favor. The 12 districts that he now created did not correspond with the 12 original tribes. Wiped out that history. He broke down tribal loyalty, political administration developed, collected taxes, made army people go into the army, forced labor among his own people. He had internal troubles, and when he didn't turn to God. And you can read all of this on your own. I don't need to pull out all those details. But as long as you know what's going on, when you read it, you won't be bogged down by the horribleness of some of it. He turns back on his faith and he just relies on himself because he's so brilliant and I can walk around in my temple and reinforce how wonderful I am every day. That's the kind of person he was. There was a palace plot to put him on the throne. Another one of David's sons was supposed to be on the throne. It's not God now who decides who gets on the throne. His wisdom made him self-reliant from Yahweh. The temple was gold, and the court became pageantry. It's all about rituals and rites. He was deeply religious, at least it made it look that way, but he really wasn't deep down inside. And we all know people like that. We all know people who appear to be very pious and really don't, it doesn't show up in their everyday lives. They're very selective about who they'll hang out with or listen to or be part of or invite for dinner. He makes marriages for political purposes, and his temple was greater than God's. That's what most people always remember about Solomon. It was not Yahweh's intention that Israel should become a nation, as other nations measured greatness, rather that they should be separate in the way they lived their lives. Not separate from having relationships, but separate in the way they lived their lives. Instead, they took their own nation to be fabulous because they were wealthy and saw themselves as number one. They forgot their covenant calling. The Mosaic tradition in the culture is against the tendency of how the world lived. They forgot. And the Canaanite world was very powerful. And that was not worshiping Yahweh. That was worshiping many gods. And the tendency was toward tolerance and compromise when it came to religion for themselves. No spiritual growth was happening. Life was easy, in a sense, because economically they were doing well. So they didn't have the tragedies that caused them to stop and return to Yahweh. Had not this pursuit of the devices and desires of men's hearts not been rebuked by prophets, we wouldn't be sitting here today. It's now the voice of the prophets, and that's what we're going to be looking at next week. Israel had to relearn that Yahweh participates in all of our historical struggles. And that came from the teaching of the prophets. Any comments? It was now God's will versus men's ambitions. The kingdom of God versus the kingdom of Israel. Now, I will keep my mouth shut and let you make comments or ask questions. It's just, I'm trying to run you through history quickly. So if you read it on your own, you can make sense out of it. You know, it's not supposed to be telling us how that they live the way we're supposed to live, but we're supposed to live the way they were intended to live during their time in history, making God, Yahweh God, the center of their lives. We've got other gods. And all we have to do is be aware of who they are, what they are, not who they are, what they are. The, you know, prosperity, money, I mean, all of this is wonderful as long as we don't compromise what we know God wants from us. That's as simply as I can put it. Any other issues? Otherwise, I've got a handout about the Psalms, which you can just take home, because I think that's enough, enough for one day. The Psalms allow us to penetrate the souls of the Israelites. It teaches us how the Israelite talked to God, David, Solomon. The Psalms are wonderful, because it takes us into the heart and soul of the people. Most of them are attributed to David. He wrote some of them. It This all began during David's time, which is about 1000 BC. The book is not completed until about 400 BC, the Book of Psalms. So it covers 600 years. So David didn't write them all. Solomon didn't write them all. Other people wrote them too, and it covers 600 years. It was compiled into a book probably 515 BC.
Judy, have you ever read the Psalms in the Jerusalem Bible?
Yes.
They're so beautiful.
They're beautiful.
Has such musical quality right. to them.
Mm-hmm. The first,
the Jerusalem Bible, it's a translation.
Mm-hmm. The Hebrew people, or our people, we're not calling them Hebrews yet, but they are the first people in world history to discover and believe that understanding that God reveals God's self in history.
I would love that, yeah.
And in history. Until that point, everybody worshiped a God that they had to appease and plead with to get what they wanted. Whereas the Hebrew people, and this is what shows up in their Psalms, that understanding that God shows up in history. We do not worship a God we have to appease. We worship a spirit that is love and that is with us constantly, always. And if we're sensitive, we notice that where God is. The people raised hymns of praise, boldly asked questions, complained about the depths of distress. They bared their souls in the Psalms. Israel was chosen to have conversation with God. That's how they understood themselves to be. They were the chosen people so they could be in conversation with God. They were probably, those people way back with Abraham were probably the only people that weren't so busy with other gods at that point, that they heard the Yahweh God calling them, that they heard. And how busy are we that we don't hear? The only psalm that does not have a reliable dating is Psalm 137. And that's not my conclusion. That comes from other writers. But Psalm 137, and this is way down the road now in history, comes from a time when they are taken, you know, first we're going to look at prophets, then we're going to look at the growing of the division of the kingdoms, the north and the south, and they each have their own kings. And the prophets keep talking through all of that time in history, and eventually they're taken off into captivity. And this is where Psalm 137 comes from. By the waters of Babylon, there we sat and cried, and we remembered where we'd come from. On the willows, there we hung our lyres, for there our captors required of us to sing. They are in captivity when that psalm is written, which we'll look at that again when we get to that point in history. But Selah, that term Selah, which shows up even in Psalm 3, S-E-L-A-H. By the way, I just met a little girl whose name's Selah. Shocked me. I mean, I didn't know anybody named their daughter after a signal for a musical interlude. And it was, you know, to announce we're going to sing the refrain now during this time, but they didn't print it all the time. They just put Selah in. It's Psalm 5 indicates the beginning of the using of instruments when they sing their songs. There are five sections of the Psalms which are supposed to coordinate with the five books of the Torah. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. introduction to the Torah is 1 through 41, and then there's 42 through 73. I can write this down for you another time. Did I put it on there years ago?
Yeah.
I didn't bother looking at it again as I pulled it out. These come from a long time ago when I wrote things. Some were written using 22 Hebrew letters. Some Psalms begin with the next letter in the Hebrew alphabet. You would only know that if you read it in Hebrew. But that's how the Psalm was written, through the Hebrew alphabet. And the first letter of each line comes from the next line, next letter in the Hebrew alphabet. Interesting. There are rhyme schemes that go on, repetition, opposition, completion. Psalms were often sung and performed. Song of Solomon was set down long after Solomon's death. And it's the love between two people, which is really the love between God and Israel. It's a beautiful psalm, Song of Solomon, not a psalm, Song of Solomon. Psalm 90 is the psalm of Moses. It's interesting stuff when you really dig into it. But if you ever just need to read something from the Bible, go to a psalm. Especially Psalm 51, I'll never forget that. Whenever you feel like you need forgiveness, read Psalm 51. That comes after David's caught, for doing what he did to get Bathsheba.
I can't figure out, there's something unfair about it. The Israelites thought they were the only people loved by God, and it gave them the right to kill everybody else. I don't really like that psychology.
No,
you.
But that's why I gave you the faith developments, because they were at a very low level of understanding God.
You think they developed out of that? Probably really branched out of that after Christ.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Well, Jesus came and just did the prophets told him, mm-hmm. if they just paid attention to the prophets.
Mm-hmm.
Has anybody read The Purple Hibiscus?
No.
I'm reading it right now, and it's very disturbing. But when I sit in this class, it's disturbing because the father is this, pious character to the community and very giving. It's set in Nigeria, and the perfect man, and very successful, and gives to the community financially. But at home, he's abusive to his wife and children, but has to follow all the rules. He's at a very low level of faith development.
Yes.
And
well,
it's so
that's her father you're describing.
It's so dangerous.
Yes.
At that level.
She knows. That's the father she was raised with. Yeah, religious people are scary people. If they think they have all the answers and know all the rules. I know my mother's father, my grandfather, who died when I was 3, he would never be part of an organized religion. He was a top Mason. And in those days, the church wouldn't allow you to be part of the church if you were in a lodge. And when he died, he had a major Masonic funeral down Michigan Avenue in Chicago. But the Masons do so much for people. They really, really do. And they don't have that hierarchy that shows up at, in churches, and those pious people that masquerade as people of God.